The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses says that he was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical care during his detention. Muslims in many countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr, that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. And new data shows Europe's daily demand for Russian gas through Ukraine has hit its highest since the end of November, ahead of the bloc's emergency energy talks. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses have told Press TV about his dire situation. They say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical care. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over allegations of human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq back in the 1980s. His family says that his arrest was illegal. They accuse the Swedish judicial system of issuing an arrest warrant for him without an independent investigation and based on untrue claims by some people. Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Muslims in over a dozen countries are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, that marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Thousands of Palestinians marked the Eid with congregational prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque following weeks of bloody crackdown by the Israeli military in Al-Quds. The occasion was also marked by communal prayers elsewhere, including in Turkey, Yemen, North African nations, and most Persian Gulf countries. Tens of thousands of the faithful also gathered for prayers in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after the country's main mosque opened to the ritual for the first time since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Several countries, including Afghanistan and Mali, marked the Eid on Sunday. Muslims in other Islamic countries, including Iran and Iraq, are expected to mark the occasion on Tuesday. Journalist and researcher Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Eid al-Fitr is about much more than celebrating the end of the fasting month of Ramadan.
It's not a celebration that should be really, I think, taken simply as a joyous occasion in and of itself alone, because ultimately we know that on this day there are many oppressed around the world and there are people who are suffering at the same time. And it's a time when we have to share also, because in all the bounties that we receive from the divine, Muslims are encouraged not only to sort of spend on their own kith and kin, but also to the poor that perhaps surround them. Things like feeding others and serving others and being generous is equally as important as obviously creating happiness and joy for our own children and our own loved ones and family. There has to be a kind of a bigger purpose to it. And of course, nowhere more poignantly is that noted than, say, the oppressed people like the people in Palestine, for instance, today. I mean, how much will the Israelis be allowing them to live and peacefully and do those celebrations without the kind of persecution that's gone on? Yemen is the same. So my heart goes out on this Eid to those who celebrate Eid under famine conditions, under bombing and various other oppressive conditions, as well as those who have a life of ease, and perhaps can those people should be sharing all the more with those who are suffering at this time.
Russian gas deliveries to Europe through Ukraine have hit a five-month high despite tensions over the war in Ukraine. That is according data from a transmission system operator in Slovakia. The data shows that even Russian gas to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 showed an increase. In the meantime, EU energy ministers are holding an emergency meeting to discuss a Russian threat of halting natural gas exports unless European countries make their payments in rubles. The EU Commission says it is not aware of any company agreeing to comply with the Russian demand. A Hungarian official, however, says at least 10 EU countries are already buying Russian gas with rubles. The EU Commission, however, says it is not aware of any company agreeing to comply with the Russian demand.
We don't have any information that this is true. On the contrary, right now, Commission doesn't have information about any country or private company who is willing to do so.
The EU official made the remarks ahead of the bloc's energy ministerial meeting in Brussels. The European Commission is expected to propose a sixth package of sanctions against Russia over its war with Ukraine later this week. The package will include a ban on Russian oil imports. Germany says it is ready to support the embargo, but has warned that such a move would require a lot of preparations. The European Union imports 40% of its natural gas and 26% of its crude oil from Russia. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Palestinians voice concern over what they see as a potentially devastating blow to the mission of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA. The agency chief recently raised a proposal to delegate some services to other UN agencies, and Palestinians are now warning of a plot to dismantle the body. Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya says the plan would violate the UN resolutions that set up UNRWA. The agency was established in 1949 to assist Palestinians who were forced from their homes by Israelis. It has faced a funding crunch for years, regularly falling tens of millions of dollars short of its stated needs. A human rights monitor says UNRWA is a reminder that the international community has a responsibility to solve the issue of Palestinian refugees. To discuss that further, we're joined by Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who's joining us from Ontario, and Khaled Barakat, a journalist and activist from Vancouver. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with our guest, Robert Fantina. In your opinion, how reliable are these the news that we're hearing that the whole UNRWA project might be dismantled as a whole? And is this something that you could see coming?
I don't see it coming. The UNRWA is up for renewal, as it is periodically, next year in the UN General Assembly. The General Assembly has consistently voted, especially recently, in favor of the Palestinians, recognizing their basic human rights, certainly their right to return, and has condemned the occupation repeatedly. Now, this effort is probably encouraged by the United States and Israel, coming as close as it is to the so-called Abraham Accords, and with the thought that perhaps another function that assists the Palestinians can be reduced or eliminated. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's dangerous that it's being suggested, and it's a possibility due to the recommendation that some of the services be outsourced to other agencies. But I think UNRWA is secure. It's too important to too many people and the international community outside of Israel in the United States recognizes that fact.
But Mr. Fantino, we are seeing the budget for this UNRWA agency being cut down every year.
It is being cut, and it is it operates at a deficit, millions of dollars annually. However, the fact that it still exists is highly symbolic. It needs to be funded fully. It needs additional much additional funding. But it's not the only United Nations agency that operates at a deficit, and it, I believe it will continue. I think we have to be vigilant to assure that it does. But I think this suggestion by the head of UNRWA is simply that a suggestion, and we'll have to see what happens, but I certainly hope that nothing comes of it.
Okay, so let's see if Mr. Barakat is as hopeful as you are. Mr. Barakat, what is your opinion?
Well, my opinion is that Israel and the United States and other countries as well who are complicit in the plight and the suffering of the Palestinian people, they want to see the UNRWA gone. And that because they don't want to see any agency or even a symbol that refers to Palestinian refugee existence and their right to return to their original homes where they were displaced from. Originally, the UNRWA was established, as mentioned in your report, to assist Palestinian refugees temporarily until they go back to their homes, and that was in 1949. Now, what happened is that Israel and colonialist power in the region and in the world. Between 1949 and 1953, Israel killed over 5,000 Palestinians, unarmed families. They were just trying to go back to their homes. And they made sure that any Palestinian who attempt to return to their homes will be shot on the borders. And so they kept the UNRWA, and the UNRWA now has become very essential for Palestinian refugees, even though if you read Palestinian history and literature, you will find that we call UNRWA something like painkillers when we are bleeding. It doesn't really do anything for us more, you know, than just a bandage and assistance of refugees and in school. It's important for Palestinian children to have UNRWA. It's important for Palestinian refugees to have the UNRWA. But Palestinians are very eager to get rid of this agency if they are guaranteed their right to return, if they return to Palestine. We don't want this UNRWA. It's a dark chapter in our history, and we don't want to even remember UNRWA. But it's really important to notice that Palestinians and Palestine is a very rich and wealthy nation. It's not just a nation of refugees. But our resources is being blundered on a daily basis for the past 74 years at the hands of the colonialist, settler, racist Israeli system. That's why Palestinians are fighting and resisting to get rid of Israel and the existence of this state. This state, as long as Israel exists in the region, we will only see wars, colonization, devastations, poverty, and name it. Israel is the cause of the problem in the region, and that's why it is very important to get rid of Israel and not the UNRWA.
Okay, so do you believe the fact that UNRWA is now delegating some of its responsibilities to other UN agencies, and the fact that its budget is being cut down, does that show some kind of hypocrisy with regards to the Palestinian issue from the international community?
Let's be real. The only reason they're keeping the UNRWA, and the United States even, you know, they chipped in the, you know, the vast majority of the funding. The only reason they did this is because if they dissolve the UNRWA, Palestinian refugees are going to ask, okay, then what next? And they don't want Palestinian refugees to depend on themselves. Look, if Iran send just mere food gifts to Palestinian refugees in Ramadan, they call it an intervention by the Iranians in the affairs of the Palestinians, and they call it all kinds of names just because we get an assistance outside of some of these international agencies. that gets their policies from the CIA and the United States. But it's really important for Palestinians to be supported. And the Arab regimes have not been up to their responsibilities in assisting Palestinian refugees. Also, Palestinians, take for example in Lebanon, they cannot work in more than 70 professions. There is a sectarian system in Lebanon that discriminate against Palestinian refugees. Also in Jordan, and Palestinian refugees all across the world are facing some form of siege. So UNRWA doesn't do anything about that. They don't voice about what Palestinian refugees are going through on a daily basis. They just collect money in order to do the job they were set to do. And the big salaries in the UNRWA employment go to Western employees and not to Palestinians. They are the executive decision makers in the UNRWA and not the Palestinian refugees. I mean, on daily basis almost, there is a Palestinian strike against the policies of UNRWA and the cutting of their aid and not living up to their responsibility.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khaled Barakat, a journalist and activist from Vancouver, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Ontario. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing your views with us on this edition of the News Review. And Iran's president has called on Muslim countries to make every effort to stop inhumane Israeli attacks on Palestinians. Ebrahim Raisi said that the goal can be achieved through cooperation and tapping into international capacities. The Iranian president made the remarks in a phone call with his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Raisi said Iran's policy is to, quote, meaningfully promote all-out ties with regional countries, particularly Turkey. For his part, the Turkish president expressed his keenness to travel to Tehran. Erdogan said that he would like to discuss regional and international developments, as well as the expansion of Tehran-Ankara ties during his visit. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountain, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of Magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in the city of Kerman, a city in southeastern Iran. Right now, I am in a very crowded street, and I wish you could hear my voice clearly. Kerman is one of the historical cities of Iran, and of course, my reason to be here is my today's destination to one of the ancient sites of Kerman, Tale Iblis. Tale Iblis, literally the Hill of Evil, is one of the ancient hills of Kerman. Tale Iblis is located in Bardsir Plain, 80 kilometers southwest of the city of Kerman. Tale Iblis is the most important discovered inhabited area dating back to the Neolithic period in southeastern Iran. This region had been inhabited almost 6,000 years ago in late Neolithic period. Archaeological pieces of evidence in Tale Iblis show that there have been changes in the socio-economic structure in the Neolithic period, meaning that the society has been transformed from a single family to an extended one. Tale Iblis is actually the remain of a 7,000-year-old township, which has been built by developed ethnicities who were the early farmers of this region. Based on archaeological pieces of evidence, the metalwork industry in the 5th millennium BC has been greatly developed in this region. One of the wonders about the metalwork industry in Tale Iblis is that the people of this region had found a method for melting the metals under controlled heat. I am now in Tale Iblis in Kerman. There is a desert-like plain here. The wind is blowing, and I love the wind and the desert. Let's go closer to get familiar with this ancient place. You may ask yourself why this region is called Tale Iblis, literally, the Hill of Evil. Some people believe that an evil person used to live on top of this hill. It's a story. Though, there is a more logical story about it that says, on top of this hill, there has been a lot of copper, which has been oxidized after a time and its color changed into black. In the culture of the people of this region, black is the color of evil. The place I'm standing right now is the remain of a chamber. In this chamber, the remain of the skeleton of a man has been discovered. Archaeologists say the people of that time buried their dead beneath their houses. Seems a little bizarre and horrible. Thank you. just imagine living in a house where the dead are buried beneath your chambers. Even its imagination is horrifying. Though the people's concept of life and death has been different thousands of years ago, you know. The people of that time thought of life and death as two inseparable things. These archaeological sites make human ponder, and this attitude makes you want to take a tour to such ancient places once in a while and think of life and death more. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The point that may be good to remember on the night of Eid, after a little reminder on Zakatul Fitra, the zakat that applies to everyone according to the common understanding of the fuqaha, or the jurists, or maraja, is Zakatul Fitra. The other zakat that we have applies to certain earnings, certain products. If one is raising livestock, or if one grows crops, certain livestock. Also, if someone has, according to the common understanding of the jurists or our maraja, if someone has currency, if there is currency anywhere in the world, which as far as I know that doesn't exist, that is gold or silver, and they have made a lot of that currency, they have it with them with certain conditions, zakat applies to that. But those are generally on commodities and certain currencies that zakat applies. Zakatul Fitra applies to individuals, meaning the person. It's not about how much you have made or how many livestock you have or homes or things like that. Of course, the person needs to not be in need of help themselves. If they are in need of help themselves, then it doesn't apply to them. But those who are not in need of help, they all have to pay an equal amount. The wajib amount, of course, is equal. So it's on each person, but the one who is supposed to pay it is the one who's responsible for those people. So the breadwinner, the bread maker, the one who brings food to the table, the one who provides for the family who's working, they are going to be responsible to pay it. Of course, if others have the funds, they can also, but the responsibility falls on the shoulders of that person. And whoever is under the financial responsibility of a person, then they have to pay Zakatul Fitra for them. There's a common question regarding Zakatul Fitra. It's many times asked, and that is on the night of Eid. There's something written in the Risala. I don't want to mention what is mentioned in the Risala, but it has led to a common misunderstanding, and that is if people have guests over for iftar on the night of Eid, then that makes the host obligated to pay the Zakatul Fitra of all of those. That isn't the case. A guest is not someone that you are responsible to take care of. In other words, they are not part of the people that you support financially. What is intended by what is mentioned in the Risala is if anybody joins, for example, if you adopt a child on the night of Eid, then with the conditions that have been mentioned, I don't remember all the different conditions, but the idea is that timing, what they're trying to say is that if that person is added on the night of Eid, or if God gives you a new child on the night of Eid, before then there was no child, you didn't have that responsibility. Now that you have, or you have someone that you adopted, or a family that you started taking care of, that you're financially supporting them, they rely on you. That is, those are the types of people that if that happens on the night of Eid, then the person that has now started to support those people will have to pay Zakatul Fitra on behalf or for each of those people as well. But being a guest at someone's house doesn't qualify as that. And so people don't need to worry about where they go for iftar on that night, and the hosts are not responsible to pay Zakatul Fitra for the guests, and the guests are to pay their own, whoever is the supporter in each of those families that's now a guest over the other families, they're supposed to pay their own Zakatul Fitra. The point that we should mention is on this day of Eid, we're told to pay Zakatul Fitra. It's a zakat that we're supposed to be paying. Those who have, God has given them so that they are on their own, they are able to sustain themselves in terms of what we mean by sustaining themselves is they don't rely on anyone else. They work, they have the funds, they have God has given them, but everybody relies on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But in terms of relying on other people, they don't rely on them. They support themselves. If God has given people that, on the day of Eid, He's made it an obligation to remember and pay a certain amount towards those who cannot, who don't have the means. Of course, that's the common understanding of where it must be spent. According to the verse of the Quran, sadaqat, which all zakat are called sadaqat. The other word for it is that innama sadaqat lilfuqara wal masakin. That verse that talks about sadaqat, that's referring to zakat, and it's talking about where zakat should be used. So it's not only, according to that verse, it's not only the poor, but that's definitely one of the usages. And we'll focus on that. In the community led by the Prophet, where there are people that have the means to take care of themselves, there is an obligation that comes with the rizq, the abundant rizq that God has given those people. He gives, let's not forget. We're not like Qarun. When Qarun was told, give from what God has given you, he said, God didn't give me this, this is mine. I had the knowledge, I had the intelligence, I was smart, I knew how to do this, and I earned it, it's mine. That's Qarun's notion. Our, inshallah, we're all believers, we believe that everything that we have belongs to Allah. God gives to whomever He wishes in abundance. وَيْكَأَنَّ اللَّهَ يَبْسُطُ الرِّزْقَ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ وَيَقْدِرُ. And He gives small amount and little to those He wishes. where they have to rely on others helping them. That's, God is providing their sustenance as well. Everybody's sustenance is provided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah doesn't need the money He gave to those who have in order to take care of those who don't have. He made it in this way. He said, I'm giving you more than what you need, and I'm giving that person less. They don't have enough to support themselves. And while I give you that, I'm telling you, it's your obligation in different ways. One of those is the time of Eid al-Fitr. This time it's an obligation. You have to pay a portion of what you have. Not too much, but that whatever the amount is, that amount you have to care for and spend a little bit and give. And that portion is their sustenance I have put in your, and what I have given to you. One of the other verses that talks about this in a more general way, not limited to the day of Eid or to the other form of zakat that doesn't, according to the common understanding, doesn't apply to everyone. The verse says, وَفِي أَمْوَالِهِمْ حَقٌّ لِلسَّائِلِ وَالْمَحْرُومِ. And in their belongings, in their property, in what they own, what's in their position, حَقٌّ لِلسَّائِلِ وَالْمَحْرُومِ. There is a definite portion. They consider it a right that they owe and they must give. للسائل والمحروم. The سائل, the person who asks for assistance. And محروم, whoever does not have. And we notice it even if they don't ask us. We don't wait for asking people to ask. As soon as we see someone that doesn't have, we realize that part of what I have actually is rizq for them. I need to go and pay it to them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William I. Robinson, author. This article is published under the heading, Global Capitalism Has Become Dependent on War-Making to Sustain Itself. This is the second part of the article. By 2018, private for-profit military companies employed some 15 million people around the world, while another 20 million people worked in private security worldwide. The private security policing business is one of the fastest-growing economic sectors in many countries and has come to dwarf public security around the world. The amount spent on private security in 2003, the year of the invasion of Iraq, was 73% higher than that spent in the public sphere. And three times as many persons were employed in private forces as in official law enforcement agencies. In half of the world's countries, private security agents outnumber police officers. These corporate soldiers and police were deployed to guard corporate property, provide personal security for executives and their families, collect data, conduct police, paramilitary, counterinsurgency, and surveillance operations, carry out mass crowd control and repression of protesters, run private detention and interrogation facilities, manage prisons, and participate in outright warfare. Now, these same private military and security firms are pouring into Ukraine, with some mercenary companies offering between $1,000 and $2,000 a day for those with combat experience. The fact that this explosion in spending coincides perfectly with continued worldwide stagnation following the Great Recession suggests that the heightened militarization of the global economy is as much or more a response to this chronic stagnation than to perceived security threats. If bursts of militarized accumulation, such as that unleashed by 9/11, then by the 2008 financial collapse, and now, by the crisis in Eastern Europe, help offset the over-accumulation crisis further into the future, they are also high-risk bets that heighten worldwide tensions and push the world dangerously towards all-out international conflagration. This crisis of global capitalism is economic or structural, one of the chronic stagnation in the global economy, but it is also political, a crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. The system is moving towards a general crisis of capitalist rule as billions of people around the world face uncertain struggles for survival and question a system they no longer see as legitimate. Historically, wars have pulled the capitalist system out of crisis while they serve to deflect attention from political tensions and problems of legitimacy.
Economically, global capitalism faces what is known in technical language as over-accumulation, a situation in which the economy has produced or has the capacity to produce great quantities of wealth, but the market cannot absorb this wealth because of escalating inequality. Capitalism, by its very nature, will produce abundant wealth, yet polarize that wealth and generate ever greater levels of social inequality unless offset by redistributive policies. The level of global social polarization and inequality now experienced is without precedent. In 2018, the richest 1% of humanity controlled more than half of the world's wealth, while the bottom 80% had to make do with just 5%. The International Development Agency Oxfam reported in January that during the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic, the 10 richest men in the world more than doubled their fortunes from $700 billion to $1.5 trillion, while 99% of humanity saw a fall in their income and 160 million more people fell into poverty. Such inequalities end up undermining the stability of the system as the gap grows between what is or could be produced and what the market can absorb. The extreme concentration of the planet's wealth in the hands of the few and the accelerated impoverishment and dispossession of the majority means that the transnational capitalist class, or TCC, has increasing difficulty in finding productive outlets to upload enormous amounts of surplus it accumulated. In the years leading up to the pandemic, there was a steady rise in the underutilized capacity and slowdown in industrial production around the world. The surplus of accumulated capital with nowhere to go expanded rapidly. Transnational corporations recorded record profits during the 2010s at the same time that corporate investment declined. Along with militarized accumulation, the TCC has turned to unprecedented levels of financial speculation and to debt-driven growth to sustain profit-making in the face of the crisis. If left unchecked, over-accumulation results in crisis, in stagnation, recessions, depression, social upheavals, and war, just what people are experiencing right now. But there is a related dynamic at work in the global war economy. The need for dominant groups to suppress mass discontent and deflect the crisis of state legitimacy. International frictions escalate as states, in their effort to retain legitimacy, seek to sublimate social and political tensions and to keep the social order from fracturing. All around the world, a people's spring has taken off. From Chile to India, France to US, Haiti to Nigeria, South Africa to Colombia, Jordan to Sri Lanka, waves of strikes and mass protests have proliferated and in some instances appear to be acquiring an anti-capitalist character. Wars and external enemies allow the ruling groups to deflect attention away from domestic melee in their effort to maintain a grip on power as the crisis deepens. In the US, this sublimation has involved efforts to channel social unrest towards scapegoated communities such as immigrants or other marginalized groups. This is one key function of racism and was a core component of the Trump
administration's political strategy or towards an external enemy, which had clearly become a cornerstone of the Biden government's strategy well before the crisis in Eastern Europe. U.S. presidents historically reach their highest approval ratings when they launch wars. George W. Bush reached an all-time high of 90% in 2001 as his administration geared up to invade Afghanistan, and his father, George H. W. Bush, achieved an 89% approval rating in 1991. Right as the U.S. declared the end of its first invasion of Iraq and the liberation of Kuwait. It is unlikely that an increasing militarization of the world economy can, in the long run, offset either the economic or the political dimensions of the crisis of global capitalism. Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. In the U.S., the class struggle is heating up with a wave of strikes and of unionization drives in Amazon, Starbucks, and elsewhere in the gig economy. The current inflationary spiral and the escalation of the class struggle in the United States and around the world point to the inability of the ruling groups to contain the expanding crisis. The drive by the capitalist state to externalize the political fallout of the crisis increases the danger that international tensions and localized conflicts will snowball into broader international conflagrations of unforeseen consequences.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eid al-Fitr, the Eid of struggling to form a unified Muslim nation. May 25, 2020. The month of Ramadan, which is full of divine blessings for our nation and other Muslims, is over, and many happy people benefited from the blessings of this month. These people spent the day obeying God while they were fasting. And while they felt hungry and thirsty in such hot weather and on such hot days, and they avoided carnal desires and curbed the human passions. At night, many people engaged in prayer and dhikr, and they kept a vigil for God. Those who carried out their responsibility by worshipping God and fulfilling divine obligations in this month feel satisfied and happy. Engaging in spiritual deeds and fighting against human passions in this month gives a feeling of joy and spiritual happiness to you, dear people, who are the masters of determination and willpower, and who exercise patience in fasting. One of the characteristics of carrying out responsibilities for the sake of God and making efforts and engaging in jihad for the sake of God is that one feels happy although one endures hardships and difficulties. And God has connected this happiness with the happiness that we feel on the day of Eid al-Fitr in order to show the greatness of this day.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We should ask Allah the Exalted to generously give value to the prayers of our dear people in this month. Oh, he who collects the little that is given to him and shows gratitude for the paltry that is done for him. Oh, he who shows gratitude for the small and rewards with the great. Oh, he who comes close to him, Oh, he who invites to himself him who turns his back on him. Oh, he who changes not favor and rushes not to vengeance. Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, dua number 46. This is the dua that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam would recite on a day like this, on Eid al-Fitr, and he would also teach others to recite it. If you take one single step towards Allah the Exalted, he will help you move closer to him. Those who have turned their backs on God and religion, Allah the Exalted invites them to turn to Him out of His mercy and kindness. This is divine mercy and grace. By Allah's favor, our dear youth, who developed certain spiritual characteristics in this month, will preserve these characteristics. By Allah's favor, they will preserve these spiritual characteristics until the end of their lives, or at least until the next month of Ramadan, the next Eid al-Fitr. We should preserve our close bond with the Holy Quran, our attention to God, our involvement in divine remembrance, our presence in the arenas in which Allah the Exalted wants His servants to be present, including the arenas relating to our inner selves, and the arenas relating to the world of Islam, our society and the Islamic Ummah. And Allah the Exalted will bless us.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio.